All right, counsel. Good morning.
May it please this honorable court, good morning, your honors. The district court dismissed this case after finding claim preclusion based on a prior federal lawsuit in New York.
Actually, res judicata, right? Claim preclusion.
Yes, it was res judicata. Res judicata does not apply since the New York lawsuit involved no fact-finding, completely different legal claims, and most importantly, completely different defendants. All the New York lawsuit did was resolve that as a matter of pleading, RSM did not plead state common law tortious interference claims against other defendants, and therefore were subject to dismissal under Rule 12b-6. The New York case did not involve any substantive fact-finding. This case involves only a single federal statutory claim raised against defendants who were not parties to the New York case and could not have been sued at the time that the New York case started. Now, your honors have received considerable briefing concerning whether the court should apply federal res judicata law, as the district court did, or state res judicata law, New York state res judicata law, as Freshfield now champions. We remain agnostic because regardless of choice of law, there is simply no precedent for applying res judicata. Whether you look at New York cases, federal cases, whether you look at the cases cited in the lower court's opinion, or the cases cited in Freshfield's briefs, all of the precedents fall far short of having a res judicata finding, whereas here, a prior lawsuit alleging different claims against different parties failed at the pleading stage. Moreover, RSM found out after the New York case started several salient facts which are alleged in the briefs or detailed in the briefs, which led it to believe it had a claim against Freshfields. It chose not to amend the complaint to add Freshfields as a party, and the federal rules contemplate that that choice was RSM's to make without having pain of res judicata as a possibility.
You say that it doesn't matter which law is applied here, whether it's New York or the Second Circuit or this circuit's law, right? But doesn't it make a difference in how they decide whether or not a co-conspirator like Freshfields would be in privity with the defendants in the other case?
Well, our view of the law is that the federal law is the same as the state law. In each instance, there is no precedent for finding privity based only on allegations of a co-conspiracy. The law in New York, there's been no case cited. The law in New York is clearly to the extent that there needs to be some sharing of control that the second defendant has in the first case before res judicata will apply. The law in this circuit has been very clear for almost 30 years that the mere fact that there are co-conspirators is not enough for res judicata. There are some cases from other circuits where some of the dicta might suggest that co-conspiracy would be enough, but the holdings in those cases, the actual relationship between the defendants in those cases and the defendants who sued later is a real legal relationship, employer-employee. You sue a company, you lose, then you sue the employer. The Second Circuit case, which Freshfields relies on, is a situation where the wholly owned subsidiary the parent is sued and then the wholly owned subsidiary is sued. You have situations where there are very close relationships, and it's relatively easy in those circumstances for the second case, for the second court to say, come on, this got decided before. I mean, ultimately, the question here is, was this case decided in New York? And where you have a situation where the only nexus between the defendants is an alleged conspiracy, and here the ones in which Freshfields is directly, the conspirators in which Freshfields is directly alleged to have dealt with involve a party that could not have been sued and was not sued in New York, being the government of Grenada, and parties which never even bothered to appear in New York. That is not the foundation for a finding of claim preclusion. I would like also to spend a few minutes on Freshfield's immunity argument. Freshfields argues that lawyers have ICSID immunity based on Articles 21 and 22 of the ICSID Convention, but the enabling legislation for the ICSID Convention Treaty does not provide any immunity for advocates in ICSID proceedings. This is important because there is enabling legislation for ICSID, and it covers Articles 36 through 55 of the the treaty. So there's a federal statute which basically says Articles 36 through 55, that's federal law, that's domestic law. The statute does not say anything about Articles 21 or 22, which are the statutes that, which are the portions of the ICSID Convention Treaty that Freshfields is relying on. So in our view, their argument,
would those be self-executing?
The issue, we do not believe they're self-executing, and we believe that even if they are self-executing, treaties in general do not create rights that private parties can vindicate in court. And what Freshfields is asking the court to do is something the court generally does not do lightly, which is to assume that from the language of a treaty that not only is it self-executing, but that a private party can come to a federal court and enforce that right. Another thing courts in general are loath to do is extend immunities. Even in the context of judicial immunity, the United States Supreme Court has urged great caution. I would refer the court to the Forrester v. White case, 484 U.S. 219 at 230, 1988. Absolute immunity is strong medicine, justified only when the danger of, and there's bracket, officials being deflected from the effective performance of their duties is very great. Finally, there is a rule, generally speaking, of against a federal statute being unnecessary or redundant. There is enabling legislation for the ICSID Convention, but it doesn't concern these articles. Surely, if Congress wished to extend immunity protection to private lawyers, it knows how to do it.
Can I ask you a more mundane question here? You're alleging a RICO conspiracy. What injuries were caused to RSM by this alleged conspiracy?
RSM has invested millions of dollars into the opportunity to explore offshore Grenada. They have a right, and it's we do have a footnote in the brief about this. They have a right to be free from the burdens of unlawful interference caused by a RICO conspiracy.
Well, but you're suing Freshfields, and they, you know, their action here was simply to represent the government of Grenada. So what have they done that injured RSM?
They have knowingly assisted in the conspiracy to deny RSM its license and to give a competitor the purpose of the conspiracy was to effectuate giving the license to Global Petroleum, which is the outfit.
As I understand these facts, sure. What happened here was that you filed your application late, right? Or RSM filed this application late.
The application was filed on the 91st day of a 90-day period after a four-day holiday weekend. Now, it turns out that when $10 million of legal fees are given to a top international law firm, yes, you can find reasons to depart from a contract, and we're not alleging
the arbitration panel found that it was your delay, your client's delay, that caused the termination.
Yes, Your Honor, and just to be clear.
And who filed the arbitration?
We did.
You did. And so number one, the loss of the license can't be attributed to Freshfields because the arbitration panel said you did it.
That's correct. That's
not right. Freshfields didn't cause you to file on the 91st day.
No, okay. Of course.
And then as far as the legal fees are concerned that you incurred, RSM brought the arbitration.
Right. So my point.
So like Judge Brown, I'm trying to find what's your injury from Freshfields. Where is it?
The injury is, and we agree. And the $10 million, by the way, was not our legal fees. Would that it were. The $10 million were what Global Petroleum, the company run by the convicted felon, forwarded to Freshfields to represent Grenada. So that just want to make that point clear. The injury here is not based on the contract. We accept the ICSID panel's determination. But again, the cases which we cite in our brief stand for the proposition that we had a right to a playing field. Just because the contract isn't being honored doesn't mean we still don't have a business opportunity. Doesn't mean we didn't invest millions of dollars into...
I'm still not hearing or not understanding where your injury comes from.
The injury comes...
Injury from the defendant.
The injury is from the denial of the right to pursue this opportunity without being affected by a RICO conspiracy. The issue is, if there is a RICO conspiracy, the question is whether Freshfields knowingly joined the conspiracy. We believe that the evidence and the allegations show that they did knowingly join this conspiracy, and if they did, then the question is, did this conspiracy cause injury? Well, sure it did, because we had a right, RSM had a right, to pursue this opportunity on a level playing field without the interdiction of an illegal RICO conspiracy.
And they also raise a statute of limitations argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Couple of points on that. As I had mentioned when discussing res judicata, we discovered several salient facts in calendar year 2007 during the ICSID hearing and the intermediate aftermath of that hearing, which led us to believe that there was a claim against Freshfields. We got a third-party witness who came forward in October of 2007 and told us about a bribe where Mr. Modell, the CEO of this Global Petroleum outfit, had paid the college tuition of the Grenadian Minister of Energy. And the other point here is the Freshfields argument is that the cause of action accrued before they were even involved. And I think the cases cited in our brief show that's not the accrual time. The question is, when did RSM have salient facts with which to allege their injury, and we believe that was clearly happened in 2007, which would make the claim timely.
Could you
state succinctly the allegations that support your conspiracy claim?
Specifically with regards to Freshfields?
Sure. Yeah.
When a law firm...
The allegations in the complaint that support the conspiracy.
Yes. The
allegation.
Yes. Where a law firm takes on a client that has a notorious reputation for taking on, for being corrupt and taking bribes, and the way that they're getting paid is through an outfit whose CEO has no record in the industry but has a very recent felony conviction for stealing $1.2 million from a Soviet oil company, we believe there is a compelling inference that the law firm knew exactly what it was doing. It was taking on a company. It was getting paid by a company. It was bribing the government of Grenada.
Well, take the first allegation. Does the consequence of your claim mean that that Grenada could not have been represented by anybody?
No, Your Honor. If Grenada wanted counsel or Freshfields wanted to represent them, there are numerous ways in which that could have been done ethically. They could have...
But you said because it's corrupt, that that shows that because the country is corrupt, I guess, that shows that that there was a conspiracy.
If
that's true, law firm could ever represent.
No, it's the totality, Your Honor. It's not just that the country was corrupt; it's that they were being paid by a corrupt entity as well. You're dealing with a company that comes along and says, "We want this license. We don't have any record of any kind of oil exploration activity, but we want the license. You know, we're willing to give you millions of dollars." And the CEO, the face of the company, is a recent convicted felon, serious felony conviction. And my point is, of course Grenada could have, if Grenada went to Freshfields or any other law firm for that matter and says, look, we don't have the money to pay you now, you know, we want to get out of this contract, maybe we'll give you a cut of profits from the exploration once we get out of this contract and get somebody else, promise to pay you later, whatever, that's none of our business. Our point is that a law firm cannot knowingly enter into or facilitate a criminal conspiracy. And that's what they did here.
This is not a follow-up question at all. It's totally aside. It goes back to your res judicata point. Do you know, does the New York Court of Appeals have a certification procedure?
They do, Your Honor. Okay. And if you'd like, I could write you a letter with more. No? Okay.
All right. Why don't we hear from the...
Thank you, Your Honors.
Appellees.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor, I represent the Freshfields Law Firm and Mr. Paulson and Mr. King, partners in the firm. We presented four grounds.
Where did that name come from? It sounds like a supermarket.
I think the supermarket stole it from my client, Your Honor.
Do you know?
I don't actually. I assume there was a Mr. Freshfield, and Mr. Bruckhaus and Mr. Derringer, who were the original partners in the UK firm. But I apologize for not knowing my client well enough to know the answer to that.
It's not called Whole Foods now, is it?
It's not. It's not. Although maybe in the U.S. it'll be rebranded. I don't know. Your Honor, we presented four grounds for Your Honors. We presented four grounds for dismissal below, and the court below ruled on the grounds of res judicata. We believe that ruling was correct. We also believe the court could readily have, and this court could readily affirm, on the three alternative bases. Before turning to the res judicata ground, I wanted to respond to observations that Judge Brown and Judge Randolph raised, which goes directly to the failure to state a claim count, which we think is manifest on the papers here. The Second Circuit in the Fridman decision, which concerns the precise same conspiracy, the precise same language in the complaint, ruled that the complaint there alleging the same injury, the same quantum of damages on the same facts, failed to state a claim because the plaintiff had failed to state a claim that the act of the conspiracy had caused the claimed injury. I think it's clear what the claimed injury is. The claimed injury is the denial of the exploration license, the decision taken by the government of Grenada in 2004. But the complaint in the New York case and the complaint in this case expressly state, each of them in identical language, that in 1996, long before the alleged formation of the conspiracy among the other parties here, Minister Bowen of the Grenadian government had demanded a bribe from Mr. Grinberg, the principal of RSM, and Mr. Grinberg had refused to pay that, and as a result of that, Mr. Bowen set about on a campaign to deny Mr. Grinberg and RSM drilling rights in Grenada. And the Second Circuit ruled that it was far more plausible, given those allegations of that complaint. In the Fridman complaint, it was paragraph 15 of the third amended complaint. Here, the same precise allegations about Minister Bowen in 1996 are contained in paragraph 12 at page A11 of the joint appendix. On the basis of that allegation, the Second Circuit concluded that a plausible allegation of causation was lacking. We believe that holding is correct. We believe this court could simply choose to follow the persuasive reasoning of the Second Circuit on these identical facts and on that basis and conclude that there's a failure to state a claim here as well. It would be the easiest, I think, way to dispose of the matter. We also think while on the subject of failure to state a claim, it's important to follow up on another observation, Judge Brown, of yours in your question of my friend, which is, what is it really that Freshfields is alleged to have done, and what is it really this complaint asks the court to infer conspiracy from? And the fact is that when you peel it back, at the bottom, what Freshfields is alleged to have done is to accept an engagement from a sovereign government, the government of Grenada, to present a contract defense. That contract defense was brought in response to a lawsuit initiated by RSM, and it prevailed. That is, Freshfields was engaged to defend a contract position of a sovereign government with a meritorious legal defense. Now, RSM would have the court infer from that and from surrounding circumstances such as reputations for corruption on the part of the government and other persons that Freshfields knew of a bribe scheme and that Freshfields agreed to further it. But that is simply fanciful as the inference that the court is being asked to draw. The far more plausible inference is that Freshfields simply accepted an engagement, as any law firm reasonably would do, to make a meritorious contract defense and discharge that engagement well. And a key allegation of the complaint should just be noted in this regard. Page A30, paragraph 59, RSM alleges that since a new government took over in July of 2008, the payments to Grenadian officials have ceased. RSM contends that the new government is combating corruption. It's not being bribed. And yet, in 2000, the litigation, the arbitration that Freshfields was employed to defend continued into 2009 and 2011. With Freshfields as counsel representing this untainted Grenadian government, which was opposing RSM's claims in equal degree. So essentially, Freshfields stands charged with taking the same position as the untainted Grenadian government with respect to the Grenadian government's interests in these drilling rights. And we would submit that no adverse inference, no inference of bribery, conspiracy, or other thing, or otherwise, could plausibly be drawn from the complaint. Turning, Your Honors, to the res judicata count, the fundamental principle which New York State imposes in this area is, and in the In re Hunter case from 2005, the New York Court of Appeals stated that the rationale underlying claim preclusion is that, and this is a quote, is that a party who has been given a full and fair opportunity to litigate a claim should not be allowed to do so again. That is the fundamental underlying principle, according to the New York Court of Appeals, governing claim preclusion. Again, that's In re Hunter, 827 NE second at 274. That principle should be conclusive here. The issue of privity, which has been raised by RSM in New York, is construed and is addressed in a flexible way. In the case of People X Rel Spitzer against Applied Card Systems, which is a 2008 decision of the New York Court of Appeals, the New York's High Court said, our presidents have repeatedly explained that privity is not susceptible to hard and fast definition.
I guess the argument is, you know, that choice of law argument wasn't raised. And
RSM suggests in its reply brief that the argument wasn't raised. The party who first raised the Semtec decision and the applicability of New York law in this case was RSM, which raised it without any suggestion that it had been waived or shouldn't be reached by the court at page 15 and at page 25, I believe, of its brief.
What law did the district court apply?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Excuse me. What law did the district court apply here?
The district court applied federal common law, I think, implicitly.
That was a mistake.
Well, the way the district court went about it was a mistake. This area is structured in an interesting way. Federal common law plainly does apply to claim preclusion analysis of decisions from federal courts. However, where the federal decision whose preclusive effect is at issue was rendered under diversity jurisdiction, as it was here, federal common law adopts the law of the forum state.
I'm reminded of a famous opinion by Judge Friendly in a diversity, and it began in this diversity of citizenship case. We were required to decide what the New York courts would think, the California courts would think about an issue on which neither has ever thought.
That's wonderful. Well, in this case, happily, I think the carom shots are fewer than those. But it is that type of exercise. The question that the Semtec decision asked this court to decide is what New York law would say about this question. I don't believe it was waived, Your Honor. First, because it's been raised by RSM. Second, because this is really just an authority for figuring out what federal common law is, which was what the inquiry was below. Semtec was overlooked, should have been called to the court's attention. That was our bad. But in any event, it's simply an authority. And third, this court has an independent interest in the correct application of claim preclusion law because claim preclusion protects the courts from burdensome and vexatious litigation, and this court has squarely held that it can raise it itself even if the parties don't at all. And I think you should apply it in the way that RSM has suggested, look through Semtec to New York law. Under New York law, the driving force in that Applied Card Systems case is the question of fairness construed in terms of the policies. That's the question of privity. It's not a technical analysis. It's look at the case, determine whether it's fair in terms of the policies. The first policy New York looks to is full and fair opportunity. Under that analysis, many federal courts, including, and I'd call the court's particular attention to the Cahill decision, which is at 659 F SUP 1115. That case was affirmed on the basis of that opinion by the Second Circuit at 822 Fed Second 14. So in that Cahill case, that is a case really on all fours with this one, I think, in all pertinent respects. There was an initial RICO conspiracy claim brought against a company and individual defendants. It was resolved on the merits. Then the plaintiff sued Arthur Anderson, a provider of professional accounting services, alleging that Arthur Anderson had joined the conspiracy that it had sued about and that had been resolved in the prior case. The Southern District, which issued the opinion in this case, and the Second Circuit, on the basis of its language, specifically ruled as follows, and I think this is just bang on, just substitute Fresh Fields for Arthur Anderson. In the present action, the plaintiff has sued Arthur Anderson for its role as an alleged co-conspirator of the company directors, officers, and lawyers named in the prior suit. Plaintiff seeks the same relief from this defendant that he sought from the previous defendants, and it is the same relief. Same $500 million and up, same license to not. Continuing with the opinion, all of the acts that are the basis of this suit were known to the plaintiff at the time of the earlier action, including Anderson's alleged role in the so-called conspiracy. And on that basis, The district judge in the Southern District and the Second Circuit found the claim precluded, recognizing that this is non-mutual claim preclusion, but finding it to be fair and appropriate in the circumstances.
Is that a diversity case? Is that a diversity case?
That's not a diversity case, Your Honor. That arose from a federal question decision, and the court there was applying essentially the Second Circuit's law, understanding of what federal common law is. I raise it for two reasons. One, because the Second Circuit has a flexible approach like New York State's, and second, because New York looks to the Second Circuit to sort of fill in the interstices of its law. And so I think it's relevant for both those reasons. And I think it's also relevant because it's so close to our facts. Accounting firm there, law firm here, conspiracy claims could have been raised before there, could have been raised before here. And as to that, Mr. Abrams has said several times that the claims here could not have been brought against Freshfields in the prior lawsuit.
Can I just ask you, what about his reliance on the federal rules for the failure to amend, to add a defendant?
I think that presents an interesting question, Your Honor, if he had not actually amended the complaint subsequent to learning every fact and issue. But here, the second and third amended complaints contain every allegation he says he did not know, literally every one that he raises, and we can go through it. But we set it out in our brief, Minister Bowen paying the tuition of somebody's daughter in college and the allegations about the known corruption of all of that is contained in the third amended complaint. So he knew everything. There's no reason whatever that he couldn't have added Freshfields as a defendant. Instead, what he's chosen to do is to split his claims in a way that he had no need to do and that has had the sole consequence of causing us and you to be here today and to be in the district court for no reason at all. If Freshfields had been joined, as five added defendants were joined in the second amended complaint or the third amended complaint, Freshfields would have been dismissed in that case. And that's the reason why all the federal cases that we cite in similar circumstances have held the claims to be barred. In addition to those bases, Your Honors, we do think you could be the first to hold that the ICSID convention provides immunity. We think it clearly does. It's a self-executing provision of law, and it is, and these claims are barred by the statute of limitations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Hello again, Your Honors. Couple of things. The Cahill case, in addition, the accounting firm in that case was sued after the accounting firm's clients were sued earlier. So the difference here is that Grenada's, the ostensible client for Freshfields is Grenada, and there's no dispute that Grenada could not have been and was not sued earlier. So the Cahill case is distinguishable on that ground. I wanted to point Your Honor's attention to our footnote 8 at page 27, which stands for the proposition that we did in fact have a right, legal entitlement to business relations unhampered by schemes.
I'm sorry, what footnote?
I apologize, Your Honor. Footnote 8 on page 27 of our reply brief.
Oh, the reply brief.
Yes, I should have made that clear. You know, essentially, we did have a legal entitlement to business relations unhampered by schemes prohibited by the RICO predicate statutes. There was some suggestion that the Second Circuit's decision with regards to tortious interference should preclude the claim here. I'm not sure if that's a claim preclusion argument or an issue preclusion argument, but let me just say this. The Second Circuit dealt with a state law claim. Congress gives RSM the right to bring a federal claim. I understand if you have the exact same parties, you can say, well, should have brought the RICO claim if you brought a tortious interference claim. But here we're dealing with a different party. So the fact that the Second Circuit looked at a state court tortious interference law and said, you know, this doesn't meet the parameters of that law, does not dispose of any element of the RICO claim. I guess the closest element would be RICO standing. One more point with regards to amending the complaint. There is no requirement that RSM amend the complaint. That's the SEC versus First Jersey case, which is in both of our briefs. Whether we chose to amend the complaint as to some and not to others under SEC versus First Jersey, and frankly under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, that was RSM's decision to make. If there are no further questions, I'll sit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take the case under advisement.